Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today I'm joined on the show by author, blogger, and scientist Kevin Ryan. We're going to discuss his latest article called How Science Died at the World Trade Center. And for those of you who are not familiar with Kevin Ryan, he earned a BS in chemistry from Indiana University and has worked as a chemistry laboratory manager for many years. As a manager at Underwriters Laboratories, or UL, he began in 2003 to question the World Trade Center investigation being conducted by UL and the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST. Ryan lost his position at UL for making his questions public and, in the summer of 2006, joined the Journal of 9/11 Studies as co-editor. Mr. Ryan has authored or co-authored many articles on 9/11 and has also contributed to several books on the subject. He was a founding member of the 9/11 Working Group of Bloomington and Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. From 2009 to 2011, he volunteered his time as a board director at Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. His book, Another 19, Investigating Legitimate 9/11 Suspects, was released in 2013. Kevin Ryan, thanks for joining me on the show again. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So you recently wrote an article called How Science Died at the World Trade Center. And I wonder if, before we get into it a little bit more, if you could first define science for us.
Well, science is a very powerful method of learning. And it's often confused with technology, which is the application of science. And it's really based around experiment. So there's a scientific method that a lot of people learn about in school. As you know, it begins with observation and your experience, and it goes from there into hypothesizing about the cause of a certain effect or why something happens the way it does. And those hypotheses then are tested through experiment, and the experimental results are collected and some sort of conclusion is drawn. So that's basically the scientific method. Now, in order for it to be really legitimate science, that has to be done in a way that there is peer review of the science and also that that science is able to be falsified or verified by independent researchers. So those are the main points behind the science today.
In your article, you state that there are six characteristics of pseudoscience, and all of them are exhibited in the U.S. government investigation into what happened at the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. Let's start with the first one of those that you call pseudoscience, the first characteristic, the lack of experiment. And maybe you could talk about how that affects the government investigation by the National Institute of Standards and Technology.
Yeah, definitely. So the first characteristic in this pattern of pseudoscience, as you said, is that there is a lack of experiments. And so with regard to the World Trade Center, in particular for the third skyscraper that fell that day, it was called World Trade Center Building 7, the government agency NIST that conducted this investigation into why the buildings were destroyed performed no experiments to support their hypothesis, their ultimate conclusion on why that third skyscraper fell. So if your listeners are not aware, World Trade Center Building 7 was a 47-story skyscraper that fell at 5:20 in the afternoon on that day, September 11th. And it fell at basically free fall acceleration into its own footprint, and it had many of the characteristics of what people would see as demolition. And so it was a very difficult thing to explain, and that was proven out by the fact that the government agency NIST that was doing the investigation decoupled its World Trade Center 7 report from all of the other reports which they had issued a couple of years earlier. It ultimately took them 7 years to come up with an explanation for how World Trade Center Building 7 fell. Their conclusions were supported by no physical testing, despite the fact that what they said could have easily been tested in a physical experiment. So basically, their conclusion was that linear thermal expansion occurred for some floor beams in the building that were heated by office fires, and that these expanding beams pushed out a girder, which is another sort of floor assembly construct, and that caused a cascading series of failures that led to this building collapsing into its own footprint. And the problem with the lack of experiment there is twofold. First of all, NIST, the agency, could definitely have put together some floor beams and put the fireproofing on them, which existed in this building, or in any other way tested whether an office fire of the expected temperature would have generated linear thermal expansion, generating the expansion of these beams in a unidirectional way. But they did not perform the experiments at all. They instead relied entirely on computer models.
Have other people performed those tests?
Yes, and what I point out in my paper is that when NIST opened their World Trade Center 7 draft report for public comment, and this was just a few weeks before they published the final version, they, in an attempt to appear magnanimous, you know, to appear like they were open to suggestion, they opened a section of their website to public comment, and some researchers, scientists at the University of Victoria in Australia, wrote for everyone to see that they had actually performed the very experiments that I'm talking about. They had done fire testing of floor beam and floor assemblies in the same sort of way, and they found that that sort of linear expansion that NIST was describing did not occur. And it really came down to kind of the fact that the floor beams were composite or made whole with the floor's pans. The floors that we normally walk on in a building are basically pans with concrete slabs on top of them, and then those sit in together with floor beams. And because they're all one unit, it's not possible for what NIST had described to happen at World Trade Center 7 to actually occur. That linear thermal expansion would not cause the breakage of the bolts that kept all that together.
So that leads us into the second characteristic of pseudoscience, which is the results of experiments were ignored or contradicted in the conclusion.
Absolutely. That's an example for Building 7, but the examples I give in my paper that I try to focus on in that section have to do with the Twin Towers, because people know my past history with this. I was actually fired by my company for questioning the fact that the results from those tests that were done 11 years ago, 12 years ago, that the results from those tests were ignored in the final conclusions that NIST came up with for the Twin Towers. So the tests I'm talking about specifically were tests that determined how hot the steel became, what the steel temperatures were in the towers. And NIST did some testing and showed that, at least for the steel samples that they saved from the impact zones and what they thought were the most intense fire zones, the temperatures were much lower than what would be needed to soften the steel, as they suggested in their final conclusion. Another example was NIST depended on some extreme sagging of floors. And my company, Underwriters Laboratories, performed tests as part of NIST's investigation that tested whether the floors would, in fact, sag and fail to hold their load. And the results were that the floors not only didn't fail, they only sagged 3 to 4 inches. And NIST's response to both those tests were they exaggerated the temperatures and they exaggerated the sagging way beyond anything that the test results showed. So I've had an interest in this, obviously, for a long time. And this paper, again, highlights some of those test results that were ignored.
Okay, and then that takes us to the third characteristic of pseudoscience, which is there was no peer review and public comments from peers were ignored.
Yeah, and the agency NIST published its own reports, its own investigation. So it performed the investigation and published the report. And in doing so, therefore, they were not required to have what's called peer review. Whereas with most scientific research, scientists will submit their paper or their work to an independent journal, which will conduct the peer review and then if appropriate, publish the entire result. NIST actually just published their own, and they didn't have any peer review. But they did have what were public comments, as I mentioned before. And as I mentioned before, with regard to Building 7, the public comments were not included or considered in their final report.
Right. And the people involved in doing the NIST investigation were government employees, correct, or contractors making
That's
money?
Right. The NIST agency reported to the Department of Commerce, which at the time was run by George W. Bush's old oil business buddy, Donald Bevins. And that's kind of curious. I can't necessarily say anything more about that, but I can say that they were all government employees, and all of the contractors that they hired, including my former company, Underwriters Laboratories, were dependent on government contracts for their livelihood.
Okay, so a very powerful conflict of interest at play there. And the fourth indication of pseudoscience is the findings cannot be replicated or falsified due to the withholding of data. Maybe you could address that?
Yes, this is a very interesting feature of this whole story. You know, people often wondered, well, if the computer models that NIST created do in fact support their conclusions, then we should be able to just replicate those. We should be able to get their parameters for the or a copy of their computer model. So that was attempted. A structural engineer by the name of Ron Brookman, who Ron was actually a director at Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, he did a Freedom of Information Act request to NIST to obtain the parameters and or the computer model that was used for Building 7 in order to reach the conclusions. And he was told that NIST would not release that material. They would not give him either the parameters or the computer model. And they justified that by saying that it would pose a risk to public safety. They said that if they released information that you would think would be actually help public safety, it would help
right.
building construction professionals prevent this from happening in the future. Instead of it helping, they said that it would jeopardize public safety. And I'll give you the exact link to the response from NIST in my paper.
Yeah, I agree with you. That makes no sense.
Yes, those results, those conclusions cannot be verified or falsified because that scientific requirement was not held.
And then the fifth criteria of pseudoscience is false conclusions are supported by media or marketing propaganda.
Yeah, and I point out in this paper that there's an interesting correlation between when these reports were released by NIST and a very short period of time people had to respond to them. But when they were released, it was always kind of a political time period, like the anniversary of 9/11. They would release a report right before that, or they would release a report right before an election. When George W. Bush, for example, was maybe trying to bolster his congressional support, or that, you know, that would allow the media to report on the conclusions from NIST in a way that would support kind of the ongoing predetermined conclusion that it was all about these 19 Arab hijackers. And at the same time, it wouldn't allow independent researchers to respond. But there were certain mainstream media sources, as I pointed out, that were more than just uncritical. They were highly supportive and were, in fact, active in shouting down any questions from independent people who they automatically labeled as conspiracy theorists. And those media sources included the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, the Hearst publications, including Popular Mechanics. You may know Hearst has a long history in propagandizing in favor of war. And then also what's called Skeptic Magazine. And those three media sources really went out of their way to try to shout down any questioning of the reports or 9/11 in general.
Right. I remember reading about the Hearst publications firing some of the people at the Popular Mechanics magazine to write their story about the 9/11 myths. And they put in somebody who was actually, I think, a cousin of Michael Chertoff, who was the head of Homeland Security at the time.
Right. Benjamin Chertoff.
Yeah. So that's an interesting connection also. The sixth criteria for pseudoscience is hypotheses that are supported by the evidence were ignored.
Yeah, so from the beginning, from the day of 9/11, many people asked whether there were explosives that were involved, whether this was some of these buildings were brought down by demolition, because it looked so much like that. And you can find on YouTube, for example, the comments, the live on-air comments of CBS News anchor Dan Rather, where he just comes right out and says this. When Building 7 fell, he said, for the third time today, it is reminiscent of those examples that we've seen too much of, where a building is brought down by and imploded by pre-planted explosives. It wasn't just him. There were many experts on demolition that right away said that this building and possibly the other two were brought down by demolition. So from the beginning, the first question people asked and the first hypothesis, I think, it's fair to say, was demolition. However, NIST, throughout its investigation, ignored that hypothesis, and they focused all of their efforts over a seven-year period on trying to prove a non-explosive fire-based explanation. And so while they did that, then they ignored a lot of the physical and photographic and eyewitness evidence that I've listed some of in my paper. There's just an enormous amount of evidence. Just the fact that one of the buildings was in free fall, even admitted now, finally admitted by NIST that Building 7 was in free fall. And that really can't be explained in terms of hundreds of high-strength bolts and connections failing instantaneously for that to happen. It really can't be explained outside of the demolition theory. But there's a lot of other things that they have ignored, you know, including the eyewitness testimony. I cite a couple of papers by my friend and co-editor, Graham McQueen, who's got papers at the Journal of 9/11 Studies about the witnesses to explosives and the witnesses to people being moved away from the area for that very event.
Weren't there people who said they heard a countdown?
Yeah, there are people who heard a countdown. That's an example. But there are lots of medical and firefighter people who were actually moved out of the way. So it's an interesting long list of witness testimonies that have been ignored.
And did they look for explosives at all in their investigation?
No. In fact, I think they were questioned about it, and their spokesman said they didn't test for those things, even though the national standard, the NFPA 921, requires that in a fire investigation, that sort of testing be done. It was not done, and their excuse was that because they wouldn't find anything. So they just had this circular logic, this circular explanation for why they didn't do it.
Yes, that's amazing. So in your article, you conclude that the World Trade Center reports produced by NIST represent the most obvious example of politically motivated pseudoscience in history. In light of that, why do you think, you know, what's going on with the scientific community that they're not jumping on this?
Well, I think there's many reasons. First of all, I think it's fair to say that it's been almost 14
almost,
years.
Almost, yeah.
And so it's historical to some extent for people now, but also in the interim period, there have been a lot of us asking professional scientists to speak up, and we found that the responses have a lot to do with people keeping their jobs. And, you know, I'm an example, but there's also professors like Stephen Jones from Brigham Young University, Niels Herrick from the University of Copenhagen. People do lose their jobs by bringing this up in the public arena. So they might not only just lose their job, they might lose their funding, because a lot of funding comes through government sources. So there's a lot of pressure for people to toe the politically correct line in the scientific community. I give some examples, though, of people who not just toe the line, but they actually support false science. In my paper, I cite a book that's written about that, and it's really an interesting book. But very highly placed scientists in the United States have gone out of their way to support what they know to be false science, and it might be emotional to some degree on their part, but certainly it's wrong.
And again, where can people go to find that information about these scientists who are doing that?
There's a book called Merchants of Doubt that I cite in my paper.
Okay.
And they give many examples, and we're talking about scientists at the very highest levels of American society in that book. So it's a good way to start to learn about how this is really a pattern and how it happens, and maybe we can get around to the point of stopping it, because ultimately it's going to do us all a lot of harm.
Yeah, it already has, hasn't it? I mean, it's just ongoing. Kevin, is there anything that we haven't discussed that you want the listeners to know about?
Well, we're getting ready to publish a new paper at the Journal of 9/11 Studies. We've had something of a break for a few months, and this paper is related to the topic that we're discussing. I think readers will be really find it very interesting, and it should be published this weekend.
Oh, great. And also, you, about a year or two ago, wrote the book Another 19. So how is that going? What kind of reception did you get for that book now that it's been a year or so?
It's gone very well, and it's been well received by independent researchers, and I think it's provided some leads for a continued investigation. It's available on Amazon, where there's a lot of reviews. I think there are close to 70 five-star reviews, so people have received it very well.
Yeah, it's a really well-researched, highly informative book, and I encourage the listeners to check it out. Well, I want to thank you for all that you do to try and open up 9/11 truth to the public and to get the scientific evidence well documented. Thank you very much for all that you do and for being on the show again.
Thank you, Cheryl.
And again, you've just been listening to a recent interview with author, blogger, and scientist Kevin Ryan, talking about his recent article on how science died at the World Trade Center. To read the article, you can go to the website digwithin.net. And again, that's digwithin.net. And the website for Journal of 9/11 Studies is journalof911studies.com. And you can find 70 peer-reviewed articles there about the World Trade Center and 9/11 in general. As Kevin Ryan mentioned, Dr. Niels Harrit, a former chemistry professor at the University of Copenhagen for 40 years, also lost his job for being outspoken about his research into the presence of the explosive material nanothermite at the World Trade Center complex. In 2012, he was labeled a crackpot by a Danish journalist and took the journalist to court for libel. I'm going to share parts of an article by architect and founder of Architects and Engineers Richard Gage, posted March 3rd on the website globalresearch.ca. And here goes. Dr. Niels Harrit, the distinguished co-author of the landmark nanothermite paper, will be appearing in Danish High Court to bring an appeal in his libel suit against the Danish newspaper Weekend Avisen. It all started back in December 2012 with an article titled, quote, Madness in the Royal Library. In it, Weekend Avisen writer Søren K. Viemos referred to Dr. Harrit and his fellow 9/11 activists as, quote, crackpots, while also comparing them to creationists and Holocaust deniers. He said, is the library soon going to open its doors to an exhibition showing us alternative theories about evolution? Why not just invite in Niels Harrit and the other crackpots from the 9/11 skeptics movement while we are at it? For Dr. Harrit, a scientist who taught chemistry for 40 years at the University of Copenhagen, this amounted to an allegation of scientific misconduct and a baseless attempt to damage his hard-earned reputation. So he decided to seek recourse under Denmark's strong libel law and give himself the opportunity to prove in a court of law the scientific legitimacy of his 9/11 research. The lower city court ruled against Dr. Harrit in 2013, basing its decision on politics rather than on law. Dr. Harrit, of course, appealed. This time around, he'll be allowed to submit more evidence, and he's now receiving assistance from attorney Mads Kroger Pramming, chairman of the Danish whistleblower organization Veron. Of course, this is about much more than undoing baseless insults. It's an opportunity for a leader of the 9/11 truth movement to show in a court of law that the science behind controlled demolition is not just legitimate, but overwhelming. Moreover, because Dr. Harrit has been a national figure ever since his 2009 appearance on TV2 News, the case is likely to be widely covered in the Danish media, especially if he wins. Under Danish libel law, Viemos, the journalist, has the burden of demonstrating a factual basis for his claim. As a journalist, he must also demonstrate that his reporting meets the standards of good journalism. At the first trial, he did neither. Still, the judge egregiously ruled in his favor. In the High Court, Viemos will have a much harder time because Dr. Harrit is being allowed to submit more evidence, namely, the video of World Trade Center 7's destruction, as well as an actual sample of the World Trade Center dust, which Dr. Harrit will use to demonstrate the dust's authenticity and therefore his good scientific conduct. Dr. Harrit will also call two witnesses. One, Jian Utsun, is a world-renowned architect and AE 9/11 Truth petition signer who testified previously. The other, Dr. Per Hedegaard, is a physics professor from the University of Copenhagen's Niels Bohr Institute. His statement to a newspaper in 2010 dismissing Dr. Harrit was the only evidence used by Viemos at trial. Today, Dr. Hedegaard has completely reversed his position and insists on testifying in support of Dr. Harrit. Thanks to Dr. Harrit's relentless pursuit of the truth, we now have an incredible opportunity to achieve some symbolic justice for all 9/11 researchers and activists. Niels Harrit had his day in court on March 12, 2015 for his appeal. And you can see a video posted on YouTube and Facebook to hear his 10-minute summation of that hearing. I'm going to sum it up for you here. He said he was pleased, and there were also disappointments, but he was pleased that he was able to present the video of the collapse of World Trade Center 7 to the court three times. He said the three judges looked astonished. He also presented the petition of architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. He was able to read it into the court documents. He also read the footnote from the NIST report, that's the National Institute of Standards and Technology, their report on the collapse of the Twin Towers. He said the footnote is on page 82 of their report. It's footnote number 13. And he said in it, they admit that the 9/11 report does not cover the collapse of the Twin Towers. So there's no technical account of the collapse of these towers. He said he thought the judges understood that they got that the official account of the World Trade Center collapse was false. And he says he thinks he should win the case, but he said that libel suits are unpredictable, so he's waiting to see what the judges decide. And he also says that as a chemist, he can't stand when the laws of physics from Galileo to Isaac Newton are not followed. The decision by the judges will be published on April 9th, 2015, so stay tuned. And again, if you go to YouTube and search for Niels Harrit, Copenhagen, and libel, the video should pop up. And now I want to tell you about our upcoming movie event. On Thursday, March 26th, we'll be showing the film JFK, A President Betrayed. The film uncovers new evidence that reveals how President John F. Kennedy boldly reversed deeply entrenched pro-war government policy to embark on secret back-channel peace efforts with Russian President Nikita Khrushchev, Cuban dictator Fidel Castro, and other, quote, enemies of the United States. The film raises many questions as to whom his real enemies were. Much of the info for this film comes from the well-researched book by James Douglas called JFK and the Unspeakable. The movie will be shown in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford, beginning at 7 p.m., and please park in Lot B. And both the parking and the event are free. So please join us and also participate in our lively post-film discussion. I also hope to have copies of the new book, Methodical Illusion, by Rebecca Roth, available at the event. And so again, that's Thursday, March 26th at 7 p.m. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.